tell me when you're ready.
Yeah, I'm ready.
You ready? Okay. So we will now just double checking. Yes, agenda item number 3, General Plan 2025 Safety Element Update, GPA 2502. Mr. Phelps, is this you again?
Yes, sir, Chair. The
floor is yours.
Thank you. As noted, you have before you our initial draft of the updated safety element. This was staff's initial attempt to update the 1975 safety element. Between 1975 and 2025, the law has changed a bit. I know the initial safety element back in the 70s spent a lot of time. I think it was 100 pages long. It spent 90 pages on earthquakes because earthquakes are a danger in the county. And maybe a couple paragraphs on wildfire. But flash forward to 2025, I think wildfires are probably more a dominant danger in the county. And so when we created this safety element, we went through and tried to classify what we felt were the dangers, the primary dangers facing the county. And we came up with wildfire, flooding, and then geologic and seismic hazards. That's a fancy word for landslides, earthquakes, mudslides. We also discussed hazardous material spills, right? That's train spills, dumping their loads or traffic accidents on the freeway that might spill hazardous materials. We also have a discussion, as required by state law, about the county's ability to adapt and bounce back following a disaster, and some of the shortcomings that exist in the county just based on our demographics. We also discuss emergency management and emergency evacuation. And keep in mind that the safety element is meant to be a general overview of those dangers. It doesn't drill down, you know, to the neighborhood level, but it's meant to provide the average citizen the ability to read about the county and understand the general dangers that the county faces. Some of the interesting things in the safety element are just the discussion of our demographics in the county. In our research, we found that a large portion of the county, we came up with 28.7% of the county, is over 65 years of age. I think in the McKinney fire, there were 4 fatalities, and all those people were over the age of 72. And age is important because we want to take that into consideration when we're doing evacuation planning. Older people might require more assistance to get out of their homes in time, and that might have been one of the situations that occurred in the McKinney fire. Some of those fatalities occurred, the people were in their cars, in the driveway, that sort of thing. So we want to take into account the specific demographics for the county. So we found that 20% of the county are children, so they're going to be with their parents. But almost 30% of the population, as I stated, is over 65 years old. We also have a significant portion of the population that's classified as individuals with disabilities. That's 18% of the county population has some form of recognized disability. And during an emergency situation, people with hearing or mobility impairments, that sort of thing, are going to require additional assistance to evacuate. We also have a large portion of the population that have a limited income. This is important. Post and pre-emergency, if you think about individuals with limited income, and this is separate from the unhoused population. This is just people with limited incomes. They have jobs, but they don't have a lot of disposable income. So you think we're talking fire hazard mitigation, they're not likely to have the $40,000 to cut the trees necessary, you know, in the neighborhood. that sort of thing. And so that number of the population, that was 16%. And so the thought for us is we want to discuss this in the safety element because it's important to try to get state funding to go through our different neighborhoods of different areas of the counties and really clear out the emergency evacuation routes, you know, make sure that the roads are wide enough for emergency vehicles, that sort of thing, and make sure that people have the resources they need to survive an emergency, right? Either get out of the area or stay in place, but everyone's informed, so we have a lot of different options for that. We looked at the unhoused population. The county did a point in time count of the homeless or the unhoused population in the county. This is just a one day count, so the county will pick a day out of the year and they'll go through the county and count everyone they believe lacks housing. And they came up with 507 people on the day that they counted. But we also looked at the state numbers, and Partnership Health had a different number. Partnership Health stated there were almost over 2,000 people that are unhoused in the county. And generally, state numbers are pretty accurate, right? Because Partnership Health, right, they're able to interact with that person when they go to the ER, you know, all the questions are asked. And so they have a probably, and they're also getting benefits, right, from the state, you know, and their benefits are being sent to, like, Health and Human Services, so the partnership number is probably more accurate, I think, than a point in time count.
Question on that before you move on. I hear what you're saying about individuals appearing for medical services, as an example. How does Partners validate that number? I'm scratching my head.
I question it.
Is there a definition for them that is broader to become designated as unhoused? Or is it simply, hey, can a person who fails to put down an address automatically gets counted as unhoused? Whether, you know, by choice. They legitimately have a house and an address where they're residing. They just opt not to list it.
I think that does happen. Chair, I think that does occur. And Partnership Health numbers, as you stated, are their definition is a little wider, because when they consider unhoused, they're talking also people that are maybe paying weekly at the motel, you know, that sort of thing. So or they don't have their own house, but they're staying with a friend on their couch, you know, so they would consider that as unhoused as well.
Would they count a PC hiker?
That's a good question. It would depend if that person was intending to stay in the county, but if they're just transiting through, they wouldn't be triggered because Partnership wouldn't even know about that.
Well, so that this is why I bring that up. If you have a hiker that gets hurt and gets carried off the mountain and they receive medical services and their address is not in Siskiyou County, would Partners count that? Oh, not part of the county, therefore they're unhoused. I'm just wondering how the discrepancy from 500 to 2,000.
It's an advantage to get the number up, right?
It depends.
Funding-wise.
We always want the number low. Right. You know,
I would really question, too, that unless Mount Shasta has a large homeless population, or there's not 2,000 here.
No.
Ain't close to it.
I don't know what ours is. I don't see that many around.
For whatever it's worth, I question.
Yes, through the chair, Haley Lane, planning director. So the methodologies are different, right? So I know at the point in count survey, I know all counties have to do it. I'm not sure if all cities have to do it, but there's certain requirements on how you count. So you typically do it one day in January and then one day in July, right? And they're just observations, visual observations. I'm not even sure if you're allowed to speak to anybody. It's just, you know, going throughout the community, so, and what you see, right? So that's a very limiting methodology.
So
compared
and you,
to
you brought it up when you first started. So the county came up with a number, but you also said, do cities do the same thing? Does that county number, does that 500 include what Mount Shasta, Weed, or Aetna contributed to the report, or is that only for the unincorporated areas?
No, it would it's countywide. So
okay.
Sarah Clark.
But you don't know if municipalities do it, are required to do the same thing?
Yeah, let me.
I do know Director Collard's team went into Dunsmuir. They, you know, they will go into the cities just because it, they don't just count unincorporated.
Okay.
They'll go into all the cities and stuff because generally that's where the population will be because that's where the services are.
In theory.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks like cities do it as well. For example, I just looked up, for like City Ready, you know, and they have their own website regarding it. So I believe it's both cities.
So then,
and counties.
What is the City of Reading's? How much?
Let me see.
While she's looking that up, my last question on this specific topic, did the county go through the VISTA up 812 and count the number of individuals not living in permitted structures as unhoused?
No, I wouldn't think the county would, because although a lot of those people, they may be temporarily unhoused during the summer grow season, but majority of those individuals generally will have houses in Sacramento or Minnesota, that sort of thing. So they have houses, they're just
choosing not
they're,
to be
they're working.
The time they're here.
Yeah.
Okay, but would partners include them?
It would depend on how those individuals filled out their partnership paperwork, right?
And most of them probably never even got paperwork from partners.
Well, if you come into Siskiyou County, it's advantageous to apply for partners because then you get free medical. You might also get this and that, this
gotcha.
And that.
Okay.
You know, so it's to their advantage, too.
Okay. That's question answered. Thank you.
Going back to the numbers, I misspoke. So City of Reading had it on their website, but it's county-based for these point-in-time counts, so...
Okay.
Whatever you see in each county.
All right. Before we ran down the rabbit hole with you, Mr. Phelps, go ahead. Please continue.
We included in our safety element some federal information. FEMA has developed a national risk index. What they've done is they've gone through all the counties in the United States, and they've assessed those counties based on certain risk factors and provided that information so that different counties can know, you know, and make decisions based on this information. And it's a good comparison per county. So Siskiyou County is able to compare its risk factors compared to another county, either in California or a county in South Carolina. But it gives a good measuring stick for the county to see where it stands.
We are doing a general plan, right?
Yes, sir.
So what does the other 49 states have to do with our general plan?
Well, the general plan is a state requirement, so all the counties in California, the 58 counties, have to do it. But my understanding, because the federal government requires local hazard mitigation plans for all counties, that all counties in the U.S. at least have some sort of mitigation plan. And if you're going to have a mitigation plan, you might as well have some sort of general plan. And most cities will have that. They might call it a different thing, but every region is going to have a general plan because it's just a good practice, right, for planning purposes.
Thank you, sir.
So
for I appreciate your patience.
Oh, no worries. I really appreciate your questions because it means you guys are engaged and not just going to rubber stamp.
Yeah, I'm not just sitting here because I want to.
Yeah.
Because I'm concerned about this county.
No. We're really.
This is my county. And we have to play games with all the other ones. That's what frustrates me. We're large, We're underpopulated. We don't have a lot of places for jobs.
I agree with you, and that's why we have a great staff, because you have such a small staff, but we're able to do way more than what we should be able to do. So I think Cisco County is very lucky to have us.
But I don't disagree with that.
Oh, we are. So.
Pat on the back. But with the National Risk Index, it's interesting. They classify like 18 different types, right? Avalanches, tornadoes, tsunamis. But only certain ones apply to Siskiyou County. If you look at page 11 of your copy, you'll
page 11, Exhibit A. That's where my next set of questions are.
Right? They classify... And they say, you know, if you look at that risk index score, 10.1 for avalanche. So there is a risk of avalanche, but countywide, that risk is low because avalanche is probably, they're just concentrating on Mount Shasta. And the majority of the avalanches occurring on Mount Shasta are not going to affect the human population. That's why the score is low. Even though there may be a lot of avalanches in Mount Shasta, there's no danger to the community because they're farther away from the town.
So, since you're on that page,
yes, sir.
And this isn't a rabbit hole because it's pertinent to this page. Do you have background or understanding of the process that the index score, how it was arrived at by the feds? Is it, and I'll pull one out, before I make general comments on another one. The strong wind, I get it's talking countywide, but it seems to me that a very low score for strong wind, when you have Butte Valley and Shasta Valley, which acreage-wise is close to half of the acreage of Siskiyou County, at what level, how strong does a gust have to be classified as strong?
So FEMA, obviously for brevity, we didn't include all the analysis that FEMA did, but FEMA does on the National Risk Index website explain how those calculations are derived and the different variables that go into their equation. And I'm now just kind of trying to recall, but they talk about like risk factors based on population, based on potential property damage, and historical.
So because Butte Valley and Shasta Valley are generally low population densities, they may have the strong wind, but the potential negative impact to numbers of people is low.
Yes.
Okay.
That's one.
That's what I was wondering.
Yes.
Because some of these... So now let's flip it. As Commissioner Mello mentioned, Siskiyou County is relatively low, small population. But drought, federally, have us at a 99.5 index score.
Yeah.
Now, on one side of the coin, it's advantageous to have a high risk factor because you'll qualify for more potential mitigation funds that may be available at state and federal level. I get that. On the other side of that coin, it gives credence and power to agencies to enact regulations on county and private property owners. So it's not a good thing. And I'm really questioning that one, how it can be so high if we have a low population. And if you go back the last 50 years of snowpack and precipitation, our county is not a high drought county. In most instances, we're moderate, but we are never relatively high. So is there a means to refute this, or is it not, is there no advantage to refute and question? 99.1 just seems, that's like Sahara Desert to me. Siskiyou County is not the Sahara or Death Valley.
So to answer that question, if you look at page 12, I think that's right. Page 11 tells you the actual index score.
That's where it gives the EAL value.
Yeah, yeah. And you notice that expected annual loss is really high for drought, because they look at Siskiyou County and say, well, there's a lot of agriculture there, you know. And so that's why, if you look at those numbers, the 14 million expected annual loss from drought is higher than even wildfire.
I get that, but what is not taken into consideration is that 80% of that dollar value is on about 560 acres of strawberries. And 12 acres of succulents and a tree farm. That's 12 million of that. So you pull that little tiny piece out, you're talking 2 million in damage, which down here, riverine flooding would be more comparable for a relatively moderate. And that's why we're not like Salinas Valley, where it's all row crops. Yeah, drought there, you're going to be talking probably close to $1 billion. That makes sense, because a bulk of Salinas Valley is row crops. But Siskiyou County, where forage, cattle, and forestry, which is relatively low dollar, compared to this little tiny piece of the pie, which is strawberries and nursery.
What about earthquake? I think that's awful high for Siskiyou County.
Yeah.
Ranks third? When's the last time we had an earthquake?
I agree. That's why I didn't think.
A couple months ago.
Yeah, but it's
a damaging one.
Right. No. The last damaging one was what, in 77? It was right around the 78 drought. Knocked me out of bed.
I would say, Chair, if you look at the bottom page 12, there was I did add a little bit about how those annual loss scores are calculated. And this is taken from the FEMA website. But basically, they do it based on buildings, population, and agriculture, right? Sometimes they do it based on fatalities, if they're expecting fatalities, but there shouldn't be a lot of fatalities for drought. On page 50 is a discussion on the drought impacts to the community, and this is from the U.S. Drought Monitor. They did a drought map for the county from the year 2010 to 2025. That's on page 50, and if you see, red is always bad. Yeah. So, looking on here, right, you see there's certain years the county has experienced no drought. I think right there in the middle of the page we talked about how 2024 was actually the 28th wettest year in California's, in this county's history. However, prior to that, if you look down here, 2023. The county was classified as extreme drought. So it
okay, but right here you are hitting on the exact point I'm trying to make. They're using data from the U.S. Drought Monitor, and our drought status in Siskiyou County, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, is extremely contingent upon precipitation in southern Oregon that feeds the Klamath. It is not just Siskiyou County. And that's why I asked the question. We've got two sides of the coin here. Yeah, it's a positive for funding to be drought and high drought, but let's be honest here. We really are not high drought. We are more of a moderate. I could live with moderate, but using U.S. Drought Monitor, their data that determines our status is based upon Klamath precip and other southern Oregon counties, which quote unquote impact the flow of the Klamath. Totally separate from Tule, Butte, Shasta, Scott, and down Happy Camp, Syad, Cecilville, etc. And it's like, is it advantageous to separate that out and say, hey, we aren't severe, we're moderate?
Through the chair, so question for the commission, are there other data sets, for example, related to drought that you would want staff to look into, maybe for a point of, you know, comparison at minimum, or, you know, analysis to provide?
I mean, I would, I'll throw this out there.
Mm-hmm.
Make contact with Jagdeep, who's at our UC crop guy,
okay.
With Jim Smith, our ag commissioner. And between those two, you might get another name or two.
Okay.
We have a plethora of weather stations throughout Scott, Shasta, Butte, Tule that have been in place for 30 plus years.
Okay.
Some of them for almost 80 years. Where maybe we look, we can maybe see a trend specifically that I think would give a more accurate picture, because this relatively high designation raises a yellow flag in my mind. If we put this in our general plan and we have Siskiyou County going to bat for its population against the state of California over a regulation that is going to hinder the vitality and the health of Siskiyou County, I don't want the state to be able to say, hey, you put it in your general plan right here. You acknowledge you're relatively high.
Sure.
That's the justification for us imposing this regulation on Siskiyou County.
Mm-hmm.
I get the trade-off is we may not qualify for as many dollars.
That's what I was going to ask.
But at some point, I think I'd rather give up the free money to avoid having to pay for something we don't need to pay for.
Right.
That's the way I'd look at it.
Sure. Yeah, we'll definitely take a look at alternative
data sets. We're the only watershed that runs north, right?
Shasta does too. Well, Shasta's more northwesterly, but.
So,
yeah.
California can have a whole problem there.
Well, but we also have Sacramento flow south,
yes.
Right.
Which is the heart of Shasta Lake, so. It's something to look into.
Okay, no, we'll definitely do that.
It's a yellow flag caution.
Sure.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Oh, sorry.
That's okay. How does this designation affect funding? To what percentage? If this was half that, would it be half the dollars that we could get that we would be eligible for?
I can answer that question pretty succinctly. When Siskiyou County is designated by the drought monitor as high, above moderate high, agriculture, farms and ranches, and other parts of the population qualify for federal reimbursement due to perceived losses. So for wheat, for hay, for tomatoes, for nursery crops, we go to the FSA office based upon the acreage we've reported. If we're designated as high drought for this window of time, we get a reimbursement check for losses due to the drought.
You get the check.
Individually.
Okay.
If we are not above moderate, nothing.
Okay. Thank you.
And not related to hazard funding specifically, but with compliance with general plan element law and all of that, there is some funding that jurisdictions can't access if they don't have, you know, a compliant or up-to-date general plan. So that's, you know, outside of the scope of hazard funding, but maybe some planning grants for... You know,
so the language in here has to be pretty specific or general?
I would say, you know, related to what I'm speaking on, it just has to be up to date and compliant. So, you know, not a safety element from, you know, 1979, right? So this effort would help that side of staff accessing, you know, planning dollar grants outside hazards, yeah.
And I guess I'll run it out one other tangent that just hit me when Commissioner Mello brought that up. The label of drought, I believe, will also end up playing a role as it relates to available insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can pretty much guarantee you, if and when California tries to recover the insurance programs in California, specifically for property, that drought label is probably going to be one of the items that they look at for establishing premiums and whether or not insurance will be offered in an area. And if we're at relatively high within our general plan, Nationwide, Progressive, whoever it is,
sure,
looking at Siskiyou County, that's going to be high risk. And so there are multiple facets where it may not be to our advantage to be labeled relatively high.
Sure.
Yeah. Nationwide, aren't we Nationwide in the drought cycle?
Not here. Not in Scott Valley.
Well,
we're in an uptick of a wet season right now. We're basically repeating from 70 through 98.
All of Western United States. Is that not in a drought cycle?
It depends how you define drought.
Well, no,
I'm serious here. Because if you look at the precipitation that has hit land, we are not. If you look at the flow exiting the various watersheds, we are. The question is why? It's because we're 200-300% capacity in our forests, taking the water up before it ever gets to be used. So drought as in outflow, yes. Drought as in what is applied to the land by nature, we are not. You've got to look at it two ways.
That was one of the problems in our forest, is because we're in a drought cycle.
Because we have too many trees.
Well,
it's evaporating before it hits the ground. The shade isn't right, so it runs off too quick.
Right.
Plus, you have more straws in the glass, it's going to empty quicker. Thus, it's an artificial drought.
Nevertheless,
it's a supply timing issue, not a total issue.
Yeah, I mean, even though the glaciers, I don't want to get into the glaciers, but the glaciers and Mount Shasta, those are in the drought cycle. Right?
That I don't know. I do know we've got a new glacier forming up in Fox right now that is gorgeous.
Anyway, we're getting off on. Yeah. So, to follow up, Commissioner Mello, the safety element isn't designed so much for funding, but it's to assist the county to just identify potential hazards that we can start thinking about how to respond to or how to prepare for. So, when we say there's a drought and it's and they classify it as high, it's not so much that we're going to use that to get funding. It's possible for that, but the intent is more to say, okay, we think drought is a hazard that is serious for the county. It doesn't mean that it's occurring now, but it's possible that it could occur in the future. So what steps can the county take to minimize the effects of drought? Does that make sense? So we're not, the safety element isn't written so we can try to get funding. It's more to say, hey, wildfires are a really big deal in Siskiyou County. What are the steps we can take? You know, what's causing the wildfires? We can put in the safety element. And what are the steps that we can take? And Chair Fowle has already stated we need to reduce the forest stand.
Yes.
You know, those
forest
that, yes. You know, so that's why drought is in there. That's why these different categories are in there. It's just to make us, to remind us, well, these are the things that have occurred in the past. These are the things that are likely to occur in the future. And as a community, how do we take steps to minimize those impacts? Knowing that drought is going to occur, if not this year, historically it has occurred on and off again, maybe we should think about getting more water tanks for firefighting in place, that sort of thing. So it allows the county to make certain decisions to prepare for the future.
I'm glad you brought up the water tanks, IELA, the last fire.
Yeah.
There was no water.
And that's one of the things, you know. So
okay, but they also cut the budget for the fire department. They had multiple fires. This is based on what's on the news. And I have little respect for the news because most of it's BS. But anyway, they showed all these fire engines that were out of commission because they didn't have the money to fix them. Would it have made a difference?
Maybe.
I don't think so. Because that was too wind-driven. It had too many negatives against it. That's why it burned until it ran to the sea. But my frustration is most people don't care. We're going through all this here. And you go down and ask Joe on the street, because I went through this when I was on the city council. We had this budget meeting. You know how many people showed up? One.
They only care when the fire is down the street.
Thank you. Or in their backyard. Then they care.
But that line of thinking, I mean, we as staff, we try to take that into consideration.
No, I was just a general term. Don't misread any.
But that what you
and
stated
that's what
there
frustrates me.
But what you stated there is something that staff has taken into consideration. And so we try to write the safety element really in plain language, so anyone reading it, just they can flip through it. It's kind of like a magazine. You know, it doesn't have a lot of technical scientific words where people have to be.
That I appreciate.
You know, so we want more people in the community to at least, they might, it's probably not their preferred reading, but if they came across it and they were flipping through it at the doctor's office, maybe they would go through it. But it helps, we've increased the font size, you know, just to make it more accessible to the community. Because the more people that know about the dangers or the potential hazards in the county, just the better prepared the community is. Wildfire obviously is something that everybody in the community is aware of, you know, but other things they might not take into consideration. So on page 13, this is an interesting, these two categories are interesting. This is social vulnerability. Basically, our score for the county is 74.92, right? And these scores are always based out of 100. I'll have to remember. Basically, social vulnerability. You want a lower score, right? You don't want to be vulnerable. So the lower your score, I think it is, the better you're off, unless I have that backwards.
No, you're correct.
Okay.
We are more vulnerable than 50% of the state.
Yes. And they calculate that based on the different types of hazards that exist here. And just a lot of that also has to do with how affluent or wealthy the community is, right? Because the more affluent a county is, the more likely they're going to have resources to prepare for these disasters. And our county has always struggled with that. We also have community resilience score, and on this score,
you want to be high.
Yes, you want to be high, and again, and they're both tied together. We want a high score here, but we have a low score. Basically, if you look on the screen, we're 60% of the counties in California are better able to bounce back after an emergency than we are. But again, these numbers are just numbers, but at least gives you an idea of where we stand and what work we need to do. So page 14 is actually the first hazard category we discussed, and this is the fire hazard. Now these maps were generated by Bernadette. She generated these, so. The first map, that's pretty easy to understand. The darker the color, the more likely that part of the county is going to burn. If you see Klamath National Forest, it's all either red or orange, right? And you see Mount Shasta, right? It's completely white. That's because it's not going to burn. Snow generally doesn't burn.
It shouldn't. Unless you're on TikTok. Before you continue, so just to be clear, and you've mentioned this a couple times, general plan, this element, will guide staff on projects, on what mitigation measures we need to put in place, and what conditions we need to assign in order to approve a project based upon its location, partially based upon the safety element, correct? In a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a guidance.
Yep.
Yes.
Now, use an example, recent memory, JH Ranch. We had the discussion that they couldn't build water tanks for storage for fire mitigation because it was going to trigger getting special permits, etc. remind me again, those permits were going to be required not because through the county, but the county was going to have to require them because of a state requirement. Because then we had the discussion and I flippantly said, just go buy some retired water tankers and park them out there and you don't need a permit. But the reason for this question, with this safety element, can we word it in a way that will lead to, in the general plan update, an allowance for situations like that for a project proponent in a high wildfire area based upon mapping? Hey, you should be able to have an allowance to build water storage. Is that feasible?
Well, so, didn't it just because it changed the construction of it, right?
Well, I'm looking for how can we make it easier for people wanting to do the right thing, not have a roadblock by the county. I get, okay, we're going to have roadblocks by the state. Move that aside. How can the county, in planning, in public health and safety, make it the easiest route possible to keep people safe? Ultimately, that's what we're talking about here.
So on page 85 is the start of chapter 9, and this is where the goals, policies, and actions are going to exist in the safety element, and the first one deals with the fire hazard. So this would be where you would put those type of considerations you're talking about, the how to mitigate against danger in the forest. Adding
policy 1.3 is specifically the one that I'm thinking of. Water infrastructure.
So this safety element only goes down to the policy level. However, internally, you can develop procedures within a department or within the county that enacts the policy, right? So if our policy is water infrastructure, right, we want to work with local agencies to plan for long-term water needs. And in order to accomplish this policy, then we could have county-level procedures that say, you know, this is allowed. But again, it would have to
make... So right there. You're hitting on it, and Rachel is the one that did the groundwork on the perfect example. When we had the mill fire disaster, what did the county do? The county came up with some pre-approved building plans for homes that could be expedited at a lower cost to property owners to build new homes. It's on the website, did a big PR deal. We made it easier for property owners to recover. Why can't we do a similar, make it easier for property owners to do prevention through mitigation, i.e. a water storage tank? Why can't the county come up, hey, here's a design for the structure, it's all engineered, and when we have a JH, a Kidder Creek, or whatever that is in a high wildfire risk area, the county has at a fingertip, boom, this approved water storage facility is already pre-engineered, pre-designed, $150, here's the plans, build it. That's what I'm getting at, based upon safety element.
Through the chair, to address that more specifically, the JH Ranch, of course they were in the PD conversation, not allowed to make any changes on footprint, right?
Right.
Very specific. But we do have in place options for this. For example, a permit for a water tank is only required at certain levels. You can put install a water tank without a permit that's less than 5,000 gallons in size. And it's done on grade, flat grade. Right? So there are mechanisms to achieve that currently in place.
Okay. Just, is it not even it's required, right? From Cal Fire to have water storage?
Case-by-case basis.
Depends on the project, yeah.
So maybe a case where there are smaller tanks in place, potentially in series or what have you.
Okay.
There's a path forward for that.
Okay. Yeah, that was probably not the best example because it was not enlarging the footprint, and I get that.
Yeah.
I thought what the county did for the people that suffered under the mill fire was a prime example. How can we make it simpler to mitigate potential threats of disaster? Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, has anybody taken advantage of those quick plans that?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. They have?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a dozen?
I think we finaled. I think we've finaled four already, and we have probably about half a dozen that are
good.
Under construction.
That's all right. I was just curious. I was going to ask that earlier.
Through the chair. And I don't remember exactly where it was, but I think this was over on the coast somewhere. What they did for water, in the spring they would fill the tank, like, because the creek, Kidder Creek runs better in the spring like all creeks. Fill the tank, and they had an outlet. So the water changed, so the water after they filled the tank would go back into the river. But you had the storage there in the event of a fire. So once you filled the tank, the river flow didn't change because what went into the tank went out of the tank. But you have storage. You go over and shut the valve and you got water if you have a fire. Why can't we do something like that?
Well, there's a lot more to that.
Not really.
Well, so who's downstream and whose water is it?
It doesn't matter. If it's high water, you're not changing. Once you fill the tank, you're not changing the flow in the stream.
Well, there's a Colorado law that...
Well, this isn't Colorado.
Well, I know, but it's universal.
Because like Kidder Creek, that is important. My kids went to Kidder Creek.
Anyway, so question back to the document in front of us. Had another question since we're dealing now. You've jumped to another place I had highlighted on page 87, dealing with policy 1.4. Go to page 87, up at the top, the bullet right above policy 1.5. says disallowing new residential development in areas with less than two evacuation routes. I'm going to stop right there. Why do we say less than two when we might as well just say only one? It's a word issue, but
sure.
If they only have one, we disallow it.
Mm-hmm.
Why say I'd understand it less than three or less than four? But we're saying less than two. Okay, if they only have one evacuation route.
Yeah.
It's, just something to think about. I highlighted it.
Chair, you're correct, and it's an awkward way to write it, but that's how the state statute is phrased, and that's how CAL FIRE.
Okay.
So that's the terminology CAL FIRE is. And part of the reason we write...
It's the feature in me coming right. out. How can you be more succinct?
Yeah.
And part of the reason we write it that way is because we have to submit the safety element to CAL FIRE to vet, and if they see their own writing back coming back at them, they're like, yes, you know?
Okay, keep them happy, continue. It's one that I have highlighted.
So, as I stated, each chapter in the safety element will discuss a different hazard. The first chapter is fire hazard, and at the end of each chapter we'll have a general assessment, and I know the local hazard mitigation plan might go into more detail, but we just provide a general overview of the fire danger to the community, and we talk about the dangers to the population, and then we break out the different population segments based on income or disability. We also talk about property damage, critical infrastructure, and environmental impacts of fire, you know, to wildlife and water species. And then chapter 3, we talk about the flood hazard. The flood hazard in Siskiyou County, depending on your location, can be minimal. Page 25, this graphic was given to us by our consultants who are doing the rest of the general plan, but basically they mapped out the 100-year floodplain and then the 500-year floodplain. Even though it's in the 100-year floodplain, that's still a really low chance of flooding, right? If you're in the 100-year floodplain, it's my understanding that there's a 1% or greater chance of flooding each year. It doesn't mean that you actually have flood. In Chapter 3, the flood hazard, we also talk about dam hazard. We listed the different dams in the county. We talk about the ones that are classified as high, and I think Box Canyon was the only one that was classified by the state as extremely high. And if you look on page 27, it gives you the explanation of that classifications for extremely high flood danger. It's expected that there could be a loss of human life and flooding with a population greater than 1,000, and that's where Dunsmuir falls in, right? Because there's a high probability that a failure of Box Canyon would result in flooding in Dunsmuir, which has about 1,000 people.
Question for you.
Yes, sir.
Kind of appropriate here. So the other, I had it yellow marked to question. In the series of evacuation maps, what was the criteria for including a map of a specific area in order to be included? And the reason I'm asking this, makes sense, the unincorporated areas, the incorporated areas, but then all of a sudden, down here on page 81, you have Quartz Valley, but you don't have Orofino.
Orofino?
I was wondering why Quartz but not Orofino when population-wise, there's a little difference, but there are similar areas if in a wildfire situation. I was just wondering, what was the criteria to include an evacuation map as part of this?
So we can include Orofino, and we could add more locations as the commission desires. These locations were picked based on, as I said, major population centers.
Okay.
And also census designated places.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that was my
that
question, why
yeah.
one was and one wasn't.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not saying to include, I was just wondering.
Okay. Yeah.
But we can always include more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But without going through each chapter, unless that is the commission's desire, I would say if you have comments or recommended edits, please take these home, because our goal is to bring this back every month just to keep it working on this draft until August so that we could have a finished product by then. And if there are changes that you would like to see, and you made it on copies of your copies, if you made changes on your copies and you submit those to us, we'll make sure that those changes are incorporated in time for the next meeting, so you can see how the document progresses through time. So Chapter 4, this was a really light chapter because we're required by law in California to talk about earthquakes, but earthquakes do occur frequently in Siskiyou County. However, it's not likely that most people would notice. The machines, the instruments might pick it up, but the average person wouldn't notice that an earthquake had occurred. That first picture in Chapter 4, this is just the areas with high elevation or a slope. In the county, you see the eastern part of the county, right? We have more mountains on that side, so that's where most of the landslides will occur. Again, with landslides in the county, it's not really a major hazard to the population. Landslides generally are occurring in remote areas that people wouldn't even know to report it because it's in the forest. And when they do occur, rock slides or landslides will occur on the roads, and Caltrans will come out there and clean it up. We don't live in an area where there's high population centers, located under cliffs, that sort of thing. So the danger from landslides to people is really low. Again, we've already discussed earthquakes. The page 37 had an interesting photo picture right at the top of page 38. Sorry.
38?
Yeah, 38. Oops, on mine is 38. Yeah. If you see these round circles in the ocean, those are where the majority of the earthquakes are occurring in this area of the country, and they're just out in the ocean. The larger the circle, the more powerful that earthquake. And you can see none of those ever occur in Siskiyou County. So
there's one.
There's one. We also in this chapter talk about the volcano danger, but there's really not a lot you can do to mitigate against lava. If you think a volcano is going to occur, you should probably just leave the area.
Look at Hawaii.
Yeah.
You're not mitigating.
Uh-huh.
You know, but we did include it, you know, just so people, if nothing else, are more aware of the terrain in Siskiyou County, right? We have Mount Shasta, everyone knows is a volcano, but Medicine Lake is also a volcano, you know, and we showed some mapping on that. On page 42 and 43, this was interesting. This came from the U.S. Geological Society, and they basically mapped out what would occur, what they believe would occur if Mount Shasta erupted, right? Near the volcano, you're pretty much gone, right? All the ash and rock fall. And then you can see where the different rivers are going to be filled with lava and debris flows. Butte Valley, right, the area above Grass Lake, towards McDowell, they're just going to get a lot of ash, that sort of thing. And then chapter 5, we talked about hazardous materials, and this wasn't a very long chapter, but hazardous material spills do occur, and we listed some of the more recent ones. In 2006, we talked about a hazardous spill that occurred on Highway 96, right? It was interesting when we wrote this, came across an article and it talked about this spill. And basically it was this retired Forest Service guy just happened along the accident. An accident had occurred, the tanker truck fell over and all this asphalt emulsion was heading towards the Klamath, and the retired Forest Service guy just happened to be coming along, and he got out of his truck with their shovel, and he pretty much saved a lot of fish in the Klamath. He stopped a majority of the spill from reaching the Klamath, and so I stuck his name in there. So. Good job for Ed Masonheimer. But in Dunsmuir, the Pacific Railroad, man, this area of the railroad tracks, in 1991, and I'm sure you guys remember it, I was still stuck in high school, but the Cantrell Loop spill occurred, right? It freaked out everyone in Dunsmuir. People were getting sick and getting headaches, and basically it killed all the, according to Fish and Wildlife, it killed most of the, you know.
Sir?
Yes, sir.
I remember this vividly. What the Fish and Wildlife said was an untrue number.
Yeah.
I think there was 9 fish that entered Shasta Lake from the river. And yes, it was bad, but it wasn't near as bad as it was projected. Just like this little fire we had on Spring Hill the other night.
Everyone likes excitement.
Oh, my God. On the news, you'd think the whole damn town had burned.
If you're going to have a party, you might as well have a big party.
Thank you.
But
I appreciate you listening to me whine.
No, I totally understand. I totally understand where you're coming from. What I found interesting about the Cantrell Loop spill is if you look in the same location in 1990, in 2021, it occurred again, and then it occurred again in 2022. And same area, same location. If nothing else, this tells us maybe we need to figure out how to fix that area of the railroad tracks. You know,
well, they put a structure there, and the problem is what they call string lining. It's how you design that railroad line. If you put a heavy engine on the top and a heavy engine on the bottom, and they pull, that's what causes the
yeah.
and I'm not trying to.
No, no, you're right.
That's it. It wasn't. It had nothing to do with the railroad tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
It had to do with how you designed the train. So,
it's a big turn. Yeah, I was on both of those events, and as you say, there's a big bumper system that's been installed along right now, and so far we haven't had too many crazy things happen.
But the key thing is having the proper engineer on the train and having the proper dispatch put the train together. It's not the track. Human error, not physical error.
But definitely this area of just the Contrera Loop area, it definitely is something to think about. So that's hazardous materials, and then we had a brief discussion on traffic accidents, but Caltrans is responsible for the I-5, so there's really nothing we can do with regarding that, but it's just, we included it in the safety element just to make people aware. And then Chapter 6, there's a requirement in California that we discuss adaptation and...
Before you go on...
Yes, sir.
So back to the highway safety. A year ago, 2 years ago, I think I brought it up here, and I mentioned, due to Caltrans acting out of fear and focusing on clearing I-5, particularly Dunsmuir through Weed, they have pulled the plows from Scott Valley. And can we work into this, because it's public health and safety, where we mentioned in the general plan that due to shifting of resources by the state, it has placed a higher risk in rural locations due to failure to remove snow during snow events. Because Scott Valley doesn't get plowed until I-5 is reopened. Mm-hmm. Or if there's a threat of snow, they've got all the plows sitting on I-5 waiting when Scott Valley's been dumped on, and nothing gets done until they get released from I-5. And we had our public works guy in here talking about liability issues of our county workers being able to just make passes so kids can get buses, can get to school safely. This is where, when we're doing this update, we need to prepare for that to give the county the flexibility to have roads open for safety of school children and other members of society, but it's getting to school safely, that should be paramount. Continue, please.
So that, on that note, Chair Fowle, we do have a chapter, right, emergency management, which talks about all the emergency resources in the county. That might be an appropriate place to place that, right? We could put the Caltrans information there and put what you stated about how when you pull resources from one area of the county that exposes that area of the county. So that would be appropriate put in there, and that could be done.
Okay.
So Chapter 6, starting at page 49, it's a state law requirement that we discuss how the county is going to plan for and prepare for and mitigate for rising temperatures. And this information was taken from federal sources and also state sources, and University UC Davis, I believe, had a report on this. But basically, they're projecting temperatures to increase in the county by 6 degrees. We'll all be gone by 2099, but for those that remain, it's projected that it's going to be 6 degrees higher if we don't take certain actions, you know, statewide or as a nation.
What actions?
What actions?
Well, they're talking about just at a federal or a national level, right? You see, like in Texas, they're while they're still producing a lot of petroleum, they're diversifying, right? There's a lot of wind in Texas and wind is free. And so they're diversifying. So we want to keep our energy output or increase it, but do it in ways that are less likely to generate negative results. Right? So for yes, that, you know, they want, yeah. So we already talked about the drought impacts and it's clear, you know, with rising temperatures, I think page 53 in the vulnerability assessment, right? When you have drought, you know, certain things are gonna occur, or, you know, when you have changing, long-term changes, not temporary changes in weather patterns, right? You're either gonna have more snow or less snow. It just, you know, no one can predict the future, you know, but what we can say is these could occur, right? If you say, well, this area is gonna be drier, so we're gonna have more severe wildfires. I think that makes sense. The discussion shouldn't be so much about the cause of rising temperatures or changing weather patterns, but more on, if these things do occur, what can the county do to prepare for those type of changes? If they never occur, great. But if they do occur, is it better to have structures and procedures in place for them to, when they do occur, right? So if you look, right, and you see this on a national scale, that's why I put the other factors to consider, regardless of on a personal level, we think is the source of rising temperatures. Scientifically, it's been proven that temperatures are rising or climates are changing, you know, weather patterns are changing, you know, either regionally or locally. But we know when those things occur, these things also occur, right? You see lots of migration, displaced populations, and you see that in the news. It's, you know, people are migrating. So knowing that these things are coming down the road, this just helps us start thinking about what ways we can do to insulate the community and prepare for potential things that could occur. Like, if you look at expected future impacts, I don't think that it's a stretch to say that when a fire comes through and burns everything, that you're going to have invasive species come in, right? And that affects all the animals. Not to, you know, you have invasive plant species come in, and then the native animals maybe aren't suitable for the native animals to eat, that sort of thing. So it's going to change the environment, the makeup of our county. So we just want to plan for it.
Okay, I can't bite my tongue.
This is pretty much.
I get that this chapter is required by the state.
Mm-hmm.
We've already had the discussion in here. We are a very sparsely populated county. Why are we having a discussion in our general plan that our massive population is going to have a significant effect and impact on temperature? It's not. I get the chapter has to be in there. I would also just throw out there, from NOAA's own data, we are now in a cooling trend, no longer in a warming trend on the Pacific Northwest, Siskiyou County included. And there is a trend over the last 80 years of the average Pacific Northwest temperature going down. Yes, we're going through changes in climate. I would offer what would be more important to put in here is that our growing season in Siskiyou County has changed. We are now cooler later in the spring into the early summer than we have been, and we are warmer later in the early fall.
Still 90 days.
We're still roughly 90 to 100 day growing period, but instead of it beginning in March and going through August into September, we are now mid-April-ish going into October. And, you know, back when my grandpa and my great-grandpa were farming and ranching, there was a talk, hey, the Indian summer was that little blip of warm weather at the end of the summer. Well, now it's a normal occurrence in September. Mm-hmm. And we've still got pasture growing in October. But we're so wet and cool in the early part of the year, we can't get farming done. This year, prime example. We were still planting stuff well into April because it was too cold and too wet. Mm-hmm. But our growing window has moved. Mm-hmm. It's not that we're hotter or colder, it's just things are shifting.
Right.
I don't dispute that. But it's something maybe to mention in here, which I think is more impactful for a county, people that may be looking to move here, how the county handles our day-to-day lives. Our growing season has shifted.
I think it'd be appropriate to put that in this chapter, right? We could put it either before the drought or the emissions area, talk about.
That's a healthy discussion.
Yeah, we can do that.
But I'll shut up now.
No, I think that's, because I'm not a farmer, but no, it, now that you brought it up, I think that fits perfectly into this chapter, right? I mean, that's why we really talked about the drought impacts, you know, but I think the growing season changed. Go ahead, sir.
Through the chair. Years ago, and I can't remember, I read this book, it was called World Population, and I gave it to somebody, I don't remember, that's not here. The world population was supposed to be a maximum of 500 million people.
No, not world.
World population.
Yeah, I know the book he's talking about.
We are now at 8.6 billion. Yeah. Do you think that might raise the temperature a little bit? Seeing how we're theoretically all 98.6?
No, I'm in agreement.
This drives me nuts. Nobody talks about the world population when they talk about global warming, the Arctic melting, and blah, blah, blah. Thank you, sir.
So this chapter, oh, go ahead.
No, I noticed, is there anything in there about an early warning system?
Yes. In chapter 7, that's where we're at now. Commissioner Veal. Basically, chapter 7 is entitled Emergency Management, and here we talk about the different resources in the county that respond to emergencies. And the county does have a, right on the last two pages of this chapter, it talks about the Access and Functional Needs Registry. This part is for individuals that with disabilities, right? They can register and they'll be able to receive different notices on their electronics, that sort of thing. And also the county will be aware of their special requirements, and they can provide additional services for those people that that require it during an emergency. However, the county itself, they've started a new emergency alert system for the county. I think it's called Ready Siskiyou Alerts. Is that right?
Or did they change? Yes.
Because they had Code Red, but then I think they changed it. But basically, that's the system I think you're referring to. How there's a wildfire, and if you sign up, it'll tell you, hey, run.
Before you continue, I think it's imperative that in this section we make note that we have significant areas of Siskiyou County
no service
to get emergency alerts, and they're not in the wilderness. I'm talking about on my ranch. I've got two fields. I'm less than 3/4 of a mile from the Verizon cell tower, and I've got basically 85 acres. If I'm in that 85 acres, I have zero cell service. Because of their change from 3G to 4G, now to 5G, the 5G does not get to me. And so we need to make sure that we have in our general plan, we have communication limitations within our county that we didn't used to have.
No, I think that's a good point to put in here.
Because I'll get all kinds of alerts, texts, and emails as soon as I cross the fence and go to the next field and my phone blows up. Mm-hmm. It's like five missed calls and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, wait a minute. Literally, I was 10 steps away, mm-hmm. across the fence, all of a sudden I'm in the open. Mm-hmm. So it needs to be noted.
Yep.
Okay, yeah, well, definitely, I think that's a good point, and we'll definitely put that in there for the next month.
Fay Lane, basically to Gazelle, no service.
Well, how did they fix it? What, different town?
I've been talking till I'm blue in the face. They need to go back for emergency uses, go back to the 3G delivery. Mm-hmm. 3G is a stronger signal.
Hey, you're up.
If you think of it on back to physics and wavelengths, 3G is pretty much a real shallow amplitude of carrying the information. You can't carry as much information as quickly, but it has a much further reach of connection. 4G, your amplitude increases a bit more. 5G is a big amplitude, but the problem is, if that amplitude comes down and gets the top of a tree, kills it. Mm-hmm. Any obstruction, because the wavelength, the amplitude is so big, it doesn't carry as far. Now, if you're close to it, you get instantaneous data much quicker. That's why people like it for videos and everything else. We're talking emergency services. We just need to be able to get a text. And a text requires very little, and that's where a 3G or a 4G for emergencies, I think, would be much more appropriate in rural counties. But I've talked to some senators and assembly members. We've got to have something for rural counties for communication, because 5G doesn't cut it.
So, Commissioner,
a few years ago, they wanted to take AT&T one to take down landlines, because we still have AT&T, and we got a notice. And I wrote them twice. And I told them there are areas in this county where there's no cell service. And they've dropped it. They're going to continue for at least 10 years. Hmm. And that's one of the reasons, just like Mr. Chair Fowle here said, 3G is better than 5, but there's still a lot of spots in this county that do not have any kind of cell service.
Yeah. We're right at 11:30. We're going to take one more 5-minute break. We'll come back and wrap this up with comments and suggestions from Mr. Phelps and staff.